You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Michel Nashan. I'm here in Brunswick, Brooklyn at the Heritage Radio Network, heritageradio.org, at the famous Roberta's Restaurant. It's more than food. Thanks for joining me. And today I have my peanut gallery here beside me, Ralph Leglisi, who is the Director of Communications for Wholesome Wave. And I felt I needed the extra artillery because we're going to be discussing a pretty intense subject. You ready for this, Ralph?
I'm ready.
Okay. It's no secret that everyone who produces or handles food has a role in ensuring food safety. And today we're going to talk about the Food Safety Modernization Act, which will be the first major update of federal food safety laws since 1938. Now, this new act gives the Food and Drug Administration broad new powers to prevent food safety problems, detect and respond to food safety issues, and improve the safety of imported foods, all that stuff. But obviously, whenever there's a new law that requires regulations, especially if they're going to be placed on businesses that aren't accustomed to having to follow this, there's expense, there are potential problems, unintended consequences, as well as benefits. So we're going to talk about that from the perspective of farmers in the first part of the show. So for that first part of the show today, joining me are Roland Reynolds, Executive Director of the Carolina Small Farm Stewardship Association. Roland, are you there?
I sure am.
Hey, Roland, how are you? Yeah, good to hear your voice, man. And Roger Noonan, president of the New England Farmers Union, who is also an organic farmer in New Boston, New Hampshire. Roger, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having us.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. Now we have a lot to talk about, and I'd like to really explore first from the perspective of the farmer, the small producer, the aggregator, the food hub operator. There's quite a bit of scuttlebutt right now amongst the small farm community about these regulations and what it might mean. So what I'd love to do, Roger, you're a farmer and president of the New England Farmers Union. I'd really love to get your take in a couple of minutes of what you really think this might mean for producers like yourself and some of your colleagues up there in New England.
Well, sure thing, Michelle. I just want to, you said something in your opening remarks there. Business is not accustomed to following regulations. And I just want to tell you, as somebody that looks my customers in the eyes every day and their kids, we practice food safety.
Awesome.
You betcha. You know, I mean, we have a food safety plan, and what got me involved in this is working with your organization on the Food Hub project. And then when I saw what these rules had in store for my estimated cost of complying with current gaps versus this Food Safety Modernization Act, I realized that maybe I went from $250,000 to $750,000.
So you're talking about like a $500,000 spread between...
At least. I mean, we can certainly say clearly it's regulatory uncertainty for somebody who is just about to take a step in the direction of getting more of local product deeper into the food value chain and into communities that aren't maybe getting the access to the fresh fruits and vegetables that are leading to all the positive health outcomes that we want to see in our community. So to me, we can get into the weeds. We don't have enough time in 15 minutes to get into the weeds of this, but this is you talk about triple bottom line investing. Well, this is triple bottom line disinvestment because, one, it's going to lead to consolidation in an industry where we've already had tremendous consolidation. Now we're getting some recent growth in small and mid-sized farms and short supply chains. This will have the potential to severely impact that, as the FDA has pointed out in their own economic impact analysis, that the cost of compliance for some farms with higher operating costs will probably choose them not to farm. Roland did a great piece on the impacts this will have to all the beginning farmers who are so desperately encouraging to get into food production. There is the public health outcomes, the negative public health outcomes. Farms like mine are increasing the consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables all winter long. Mm-hmm. How much kale was not the hot commodity it was 10 years ago.
Yeah,
you know,
I got my Eat Kale shirt. I wear it all
exactly,
the time.
Just, right? you know, so, I mean, you know, now guys are shipping that. The big shipper packers are putting a lot of kale and bok choy and kohlrabi, and they're putting a lot more of that stuff onto grocery shelves, and people are consuming a lot more of it because of the focus, I think, that rightly so, that this administration, USDA, has made in promoting eating local. And that connection between the consumer and the farmer is spurring better health outcomes.
So,
deeper into the schools through food hubs for small farms, it's important to aggregate.
Well, schools and corner stores, places that generally
exactly.
don't have this access. So one of the things I want to wind back to, Roger, because you hit it. You really hit it when you said that, you know, with the food hub movement, with and frankly, as a result of the 2008 Farm Bill,
right.
you know, federal investment in seeing these small and mid-sized farms grow, what you're seeing coming down the pike here is something that actually could stop that growth dead in its tracks. So, you know, that's something that's huge. And then I definitely want to get to Roland because I want to speak up about the perspective of farmers who are entering this business in the food place in the first place. So getting to that place of growth, tell me what you see as the issue areas of these new regulations that are coming that are going to cause this type of expense increase in your business operation that would disincentivize you from growing your business.
Is that for
sure.
me?
Well, when you want to talk about the economic impacts, I mean, you can start by just looking at what FDA's own estimates of the economic impact of these rules are going to be. They project that to comply with the, to comply with the rules governing on-farm produce production, FDA estimates that the cost of complying with water testing requirements, with the cost of soil amendment and fertility amendments, with the cost of ensuring cleanliness of facilities, of training workers, and all this, all of their costs, they estimate that for a farm that grosses less than $250,000 a year, they're going to spend 6% of their revenue to comply with this rule every year. Now, according to the USDA,
so that's like $13,000. That's a lot of money.
Say again.
That's like $13,000. That's a lot of money.
Exactly right. And the typical American farm, $250,000 in revenue, only makes a net margin of 10%. So we're talking about cutting the net margin in half, and that doesn't make a very appetizing prospect for a young person, a young family, or a second career family that is looking to make a career helping people eat better. I mean, we've got to remember that this movement around local food and short supply chains is, just like Roger elaborated on, is about making people healthier. You know, we have 50,000 people who die every year in this country from colon cancer. We have 250,000 people who die every year in this country from complications of diabetes. 800,000 people who die from heart disease. Our diet is killing us, but it's the nutritional quality of our diet that is the problem. And by squashing the growth of local food and people who are in the business because they want to be a part of this solution to that health problem is only going to exacerbate that health problem end up resulting in more consolidation of the food and the produce industry, and in particular the offshoring of our produce sources. It will more and more be foreign suppliers that pick up the slack as our local producers shrivel and are no longer able to compete.
Now, I'm going to ask Ralph to bring me back to that point in a second because I think that's really interesting. But one of the things that Ralph and I were talking about before before we got the show going, was that produce illnesses and deaths between 1996 and 2010 were 14,000 illnesses and 34 deaths, you know, in sequence, 14,000 illnesses and 34 deaths compared to 47 million illnesses and 3,000 deaths per year overall, much of which is linked to, you know, fast food, animal protein products, et cetera, et cetera. So, one would say 34 deaths over, you know, 20 plus years, 14,000 illnesses from produce. And my recollection, like the last big spinach outbreak, was a really large, really large spinach farm located in a place where there was intensive animal agriculture. Now, for the record, Roger, you're in an area of the country where obviously the average size farm is much smaller than probably a hedgerow of the farm that this outbreak originated from, and they never really traced it back to the water origins. But the majority of the farms in the regions that we're talking about, whether it's, you know, small to mid-sized farmers in North Carolina, the Carolinas proper in Georgia, or you go into New England, you guys' farms are not bordering, you know, these concentrated animal feeding operations, correct?
They're certainly not up in the New England area, because we don't have, we're not close proximity to massive amounts of corn and soybean to fatten them on. So, you know, we'll have a dairy farm or whatnot, but I look forward to seeing a dairy farm close to me so I can get that manure to put on my fields to make them nice and fertile. But, it is a little different in other parts of the country. And I think that a lot of what the local and regional foods movement really does is leverage these farms in and around our urban centers and our suburban areas, which, like I said, you know, I know that what I do brings a benefit to the Western growers, in the Salinas Valley. They're selling more because of guys like me and the folks that Roland represents, we're delivering this produce year-round. We're getting people energized and excited. When you have kids, and I've seen kids grow up on my farm, coming here weekly with their parents that crave things like kale. You know, that wasn't something, Michelle, that I grew up craving kale when I went, to the...
For me, it was collard greens, and I did grow up craving them, but my mom was a Southerner, so...
Your mom knew how to throw a hammock in there.
Yeah, she sure did. Yeah.
Right.
So now, for both of you guys, Roland, you're an attorney, and right. I know a lot of the pressure here is because there, what happens when things like this happen is a bunch of information goes out, articles get written, and then, it can get pretty confusing. And one of the issues that came up is this whole scorched earth approach that's happening out in Salinas and some in Fresno and some of the other areas where you see these 40-foot barriers that are required, fences, impinging on riparian or actually destroying riparian areas. But that, from my understanding of this, is that this is something that's actually been created by the legal departments of some pretty large food companies, fast food companies, big box retailers. And I would assume that this is a risk mitigation move by them to see that if they're enforcing these standards on some of these growers, then if there is some kind of a breach in the system where there's a foodborne illness, their risk is mitigated. They get to push the blame upstream to the actual produce producer. Do you guys have a fear of these types of regulations actually starting to inform some of the rules that are coming out of FDA? Because I haven't seen anything in the rules that indicate they're moving towards this scorched earth thing. I'd just like to clear the air on that.
Sure.
What do you see?
Well, I think you hit the issue on the head in terms of the risk being the hot potato here, and the folks at the end of the food chain would love to kick that risk back down to the previous ladders in the chain, and the farmers can't push it back to anybody else. So you encapsulated the risk that in terms of the viability of farms from this whole from passing that whole hot potato down the line. I think that there is. No doubt from looking at the regulations that they are going to encourage more use of synthetic fertilizers, because they make it so difficult to use compost. I think you are certainly going to see that, depending on what particular inspector or buyer says, those scorched earth policies, those elimination of riparian buffers, that these rules won't reduce that for sure. They certainly aren't going to, the extent that a retail chain, a grocery store, wants to impose higher standards than FSMA and wants to require those kind of scorched earth policies, there's nothing here that's going to stop that. Yeah. And that gets to the whole environmental leg of the triple bottom line mm-hmm. disinvestment that these rules represent.
Now, it's interesting because you struck a chord with me because I own a restaurant. I've been a chef for over 35 years,
sure.
and I deal with local health departments. While I absolutely believe in some regulation, there's no question about it. That health regulations in the restaurant industry have absolutely saved lives. They've raised the bar. But what happens with you have your minimum federal standard. And then states and municipalities have to follow that minimum standard, but they can actually do what I call piling on and add their own rules and regulations as long as they enhance and do not detract from existing regulations. So what I heard from you, Roland, is something that resonates with me because, you're going to have the FSMA standards, and if local health authorities want to take it farther, they're going to have the license to do that. Wouldn't this be something that would be interesting to talk to they say they're open for comment. Wouldn't it be something to fight for to actually disallow? Or do you think that that's just not possible?
I certainly think it's a complex legal question. As you say, there is always this opportunity for piling on, and particularly when it's going to come from the private industry. It's one thing for FDA and the federal government to preempt a field of regulatory activity, but it's another for the FDA to say, oh, and Wegmans, you can't have higher standards, or Costco, you can't have higher standards than this. That's going to be very complicated. Obviously, those particular entities might resist some sort of limitation on their ability to control the supply that they're getting. But you're absolutely right that it is something that is worth fighting for. Already, these many retail buyers, wholesale buyers, require farms to register with the FDA, even though the FDA doesn't require those farms to register. And it's just an example of how in this whole complex issue of trying to manage the safety of our food, we end up hammering it at flies with sledgehammers.
That's an incredible analogy. Now, Roger, before we go to break, I apologize. We have so many guests joining us today that we could almost give this just the conversation with the three of us a full hour. But when I want to get back to the fact that, you are a small producer, you co-op with and you work with and collaborate with a network of producers and aggregators, et cetera. You're full, taking full run into Food Hub activity. You're definitely following local health regulations now. What do you see coming down the pipe in these FDA rules that if you had an opportunity to say to the FDA today and you actually believe that you had, a willing ear, what are the things that bother you the most?
Well, first I'll say that so far, I think, and Roland will probably echo this, that we've had a willing ear. I mean, the process so far, I wish we were at the table a year or two ago, but we're there now. And I think we are having the conversation, and we are getting the access, and we have the comment period, and we're trying to get folks mobilized to farmers to look up from their work to make comments, because FDA just hasn't looked at the kind of farming we do, and so this is really news to them. We're not down there. We don't have offices in D.C. where we can constantly go over and answer the questions as they pop up. So it's a little bit of a heavier lift for FDA to reach out to guys like me. Roland. So, but you've said something earlier. You just said the minimum standards. And this is a minimum standard, and there will certainly be industry. I think particularly industry will demand higher standards, and that's how they will further differentiate between local and safer because it's not local. And there was a report from Rabobank that kind of alluded to the, I think, the strategy that we'll see unfold there. But again, I want to kind of focus on where I see the problem for small farms, for mid-sized farms, and farms that are not in the major production areas of the Southwest or California. I don't have a staff of scientists on my farm. I don't have a PhD out in the barn just waiting to develop an alternative method. Like in HACCP, like in your restaurant, you can probably have an alternative plan that provides the same level of public health. Well, that's provided for in this rule as well. And, I'm going to have to go to my extension personnel or my land-grant university, a group of us, and we'll have to say, well, can you create us some science? And they're not very well-funded. So it's going to be a challenge to get to develop these alternatives. And again, that's going to be further separating, the big from the small. And it's it's a Rubik's Cube. Ariane Lotti, our deputy policy director for the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, referred to this the other day in a conference as a Rubik's Cube. You think you got one side figured out on this rule. There's like five rules.
Yeah.
You think you got all green on one side, and then everything else is gone.
And there's a frickin' red cube in there somewhere. Yeah, I hear you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so many pieces, and they're so interrelated, and we've got third-party verification coming out. So right now, it's unlikely it'll be inspected, but I think what will happen is that a buyer will require you to be inspected.
Mm.
So let's say you're selling to Costco. Well, suddenly Costco says, well, it's great that you're in compliance with this rule, but how are you going to prove it? You're going to have to get a third-party verification, and that's going to cost, that's going to definitely inflate FDA's extremely poor estimations of the cost. I mean, the cost estimates, we talked about $13,000 for a mid-sized farm. I calculated on my farm alone, I was at $7,000 just doing my water quality testing. So I was over half just on one of the five
parts. On one issue,
parts,
right. Yeah, interesting.
You know?
Yeah, so it almost sounds to me like the ask for USDA is to extend the comment period. That's one ask.
FDA.
I'm sorry, I meant FDA.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I've been working so much on the farm bill that I'm getting the DAs mixed up.
Stuff, so.
Okay. So, that sounds like one of them. And the other one might also be the actual revenue size that they're looking at for some of these facilities. Not a lot of the food hubs that I've had experience working with aren't at that level where they're going to be doing business with Walmart anytime soon. They're really looking to get into grade schools, to corner stores, to IGAs and stuff like that.
Here's a key piece of this rule. Yeah. This is what really, we got to start here. The definition of a farm. A farm, according to FDA, only produces and prepares for commerce its own raw agricultural commodities. The minute I buy in Roland sweet corn to send to that school or to that food bank or that senior farmer market nutrition program, I'm now at least a mixed-type facility. If that facility, that food hub, is not on a farm, it becomes a facility. And there may be modified requirements that are somewhat less than the full dearth of regulation, but it is still going to be an extremely expensive proposition and almost require a full-time person just to manage that. And as you know, the economics of food hubs are about as good as the economics of a farm. So,
or a restaurant.
Don't have a
or
lot
a restaurant,
of
by the way. I hear you.
Yeah.
Or a restaurant.
Or a restaurant.
Yeah,
the margins are, you can have a good year, but you're going to have mostly a lot of just so-so years. And that's just...
And a couple of bad years wash it all. Well, listen, guys, I so wish Roland and Roger that we had a little more time, but this gives me really, really, really great information, moving into the next part of the show. So I can't tell you guys how much I appreciate your being on. This is a big, big issue, and it sounds, like the big ask to FDA is extend the comment period and set a really, really big table because they're about 2 years and probably, a couple of hundred small, mid-sized farmers, aggregators, and food hub operators behind on getting the information that they really need to understand these businesses and what the potential impact of this could be.
Yeah, I think they've got a court decision that's kind of limited the ability to extend, but perhaps an interim rule, and then we can take another look at it after they kind of assimilate all the information that they've got on the first one might be a,
Yeah, interesting. Go ahead.
Better outcome.
Michelle, just to get to your point about, economic thresholds for application of the rule, there are farms and Some food facilities, if they're less than $500,000 in revenue, are subject to modified requirements under these rules. But the fact is there's very, very few, a lot fewer than FDA estimates, of farms and facilities that will actually qualify for those modified exemptions. You have to sell at least half of your food in direct markets, and according to USDA data, the vast majority of farms that sell some direct market sell maybe 20 or 30% of their food in those direct markets. So they're not going to qualify for these modified requirements, and they're going to be the vast majority of farms are going to end up facing the full brunt of these regs.
And Michelle, just in case you don't know, they did extend till November 15th the comment period for the produce rule and preventive controls rule. That was officially announced today. So.
Oh, that's awesome! That's
good
awesome,
work.
But it's awesome, but maybe not enough time. That's what I'm thinking.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. Like I said, I wish we had been more fully engaged a year or so ago.
All right. Yeah. Well, we'll work on all of that together, guys. Thank you so much for taking
thank
your
you.
Time and being on the call today. And keep listening in. I'm going to have Eric Olson up next from Pew Charitable Trust talking about the consumer perspective on this. It's More Than Food. I'm Michelle Nashan. Roland McReynolds and Roger Noonan, thanks a million for being with us. We'll be back after break. Hi, it's Michelle Nashan. Welcome back to It's More Than Food, and we're talking about food safety on farms. The Food Safety Modernization Act, which was signed into law by President Obama recently over the last couple of years, is now beginning to manifest itself in rules and regulations. We heard from a couple of concerned farmers and food hub operators early in the show, and now we're going to hear about what's at stake for the public regarding food safety and agriculture. With me is Eric Olson, Senior Director of the Food Portfolio for the Pew Charitable Trusts. Really intelligent guy. I know Eric pretty well, and I think he's going to be a great voice on this. And we also have Dave Jackson from Enterprise Farm, 95-acre or certified organic farm in the Pioneer Valley of Massachusetts, who's really been involved in aggregation distribution, some light processing and stuff like that. Eric, are you with us?
I'm here.
Yes, Eric, good to hear your voice. David, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome.
Hear your voice too.
Yeah, good to hear your voice. David and I go way back, Eric. We had back in the late 90s and early 2000s, we were doing what we call the New American Farmer Initiative, getting immigrant farm goods from Massachusetts to celebrity chefs in New York City, and it was a blast. And I know Dave to be a really good businessman, so it's great to have you here, Dave, for the business perspective regarding what this Food Safety Modernization Act might mean for you. So, Eric, I don't know if you were listening earlier.
I was unfortunately unable to hear most of what was talked about, so I apologize for that.
Oh, no worries. So in short, basically, what Roger and Roland were talking about was that, you know, some of these regulations are going to force small producers the type of expense that's really going to erode close to 60% of what little profits they get in a good year. Basically, the cost of these regulations could drive their feeling is that this could drive small mid-sized farmers, beginning farmers, food operators away from farming in general. Now, I know that Pew watches these things closely. You've done amazing work, really looking at the industrial farm industry and really the impacts of that on environmental health, human health. You guys really, when you dive into a subject, you dive deeply. So give us a little bit of at least a surface dive here of where you guys come out on this act and what you think the balance is for small producers compared to the risks that consumers are going to see if we didn't have this style of regulation.
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, I think we need to step back and look at what's at stake here. We have about 48 million people every year that get sick from foodborne illness. About 128,000 of them end up in the hospital, and about 3,000 of them die. So, you know, we do have an issue with food safety. We have something in the neighborhood. Over 130 outbreaks have occurred from foodborne disease, from contaminated produce alone, in the last 15 or so years, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So, you know, it's not an insignificant issue. We all remember, you know, some of these big outbreaks of late with cyclospora happening now that's in the news with salad. You know, we've had these cantaloupe outbreaks. And although the ones that tend to make the headlines are the big ones from big industry, and those tend to affect the most people, there are quite a few outbreaks from smaller sources. They don't get picked up in the news or picked up as much, but, you know, we've had several of them. We had a big outbreak of salmonella from the relatively small farm last year, and we've had E. coli from strawberries and Campylobacter outbreak from peas from small farms, and a cabbage outbreak recently. So they happen on occasion, but they don't make as much news. So the bottom line is that, obviously, no matter where your food is coming from, you want to make sure it's safe. And the question is sort of, how do you walk that tightrope between being too prescriptive and over-regulating while still making sure that consumers, when they go into the grocery store, when they go wherever they're going to buy food, are getting a product that is safe and that they're not going to get sick or, God forbid, you know, have a child get sick and even worse. And as you know, we work with a lot of victims groups who have, you know, or parents of kids that have passed away from outbreaks and that kind of thing. So we try to keep a close eye on that kind of balancing act. And honestly, that's one of the reasons that we've been working very closely with some of the farm groups and others to try to make sure that some of the rules are written in a way that's going to address where the problems are and as necessary, adjust the requirements for smaller farms. So I'm not sure how much you got into details in the earlier discussion, but there are pretty specific exemptions from the rules for example, for the really small farms, that if you sell less than $25,000 worth of food a year, you're completely exempt. And then if you're one of the smaller guys with under $500,000 of sales per food sales a year, and you sell mostly in directly to consumers or to retail food establishments or restaurants, then in your area, then you're also going to be exempt. So, you know, I think there's some reasonable exemptions in there. There's discussion about whether, you know, at what level you need to exempt completely versus have modified requirements, and that's, I think, all fair game for discussion.
Okay, so you feel that there's still an opportunity to influence some of this conversation, because one of the things that Roland and Roger were saying earlier is that one of the requirements, for instance, is that if you can prove that more than 50% of what you're selling is going direct to consumer, then that qualifies you to these exemptions, and their feeling is that in most of their cases, with especially the small and mid-sized farmers that are starting to get into the food hub business, the broader aggregation distribution business, which actually allows this greater, you know, distribution and deeper penetration of local and regional agriculture, which I know you're in favor of. I know this mm-hmm. about you. I hope you don't mind my saying that publicly. I know
yep.
that I know you dig this
yep.
in the positive potential impacts on the environment because of that style of farming, that they're actually closer to maybe 20% of what they're actually selling is going to a qualified end user that would help regulate. So you're saying that there's still room for discussion in this stuff.
Well,
to your knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the really small guys, the 25,000 and under, are completely out. They don't have to make any further demonstration.
Right.
The guys that are under $500,000, if they're selling over half, either to a restaurant or retail, or they're selling directly to consumers, then they're out as long as the restaurant or retail are within 275 miles away or in the same state. So, yeah, I mean, that's set by Congress, sort of the parameters of that, but exactly how you define some of the exact terms, I think, is still up for discussion. And obviously, you know, there comes a point where a business is large enough that you want to make sure, you know, if you're selling $500,000 worth of produce, for example, that's not an inconsequential amount of produce, and you want to make sure that there's at least some attention being given to assuring basic things like that the people that are picking it don't have poop on their hands.
Stuff
like that. You know, so that's basically what we're talking about here. Is it's not super rocket science kind of stuff. And, you know, FDA's estimates are that for the really small operations, it's around $4,000 or $5,000 a year for a farm to comply. For the bigger ones, you know, the farms that are slightly bigger than that, it's you know, something like $12,000 a year.
Right.
So that can be a significant expense for a really tiny farm. The really little guys, we think, appropriately are exempted under the proposal.
Right.
But, you know, at some point, you know, you got to balance the issue of, you know, we've worked with one family where their child ate a smoothie that had fresh spinach in it. Their mom wanted to make sure that the kid was healthy, and the kid got E. coli from the smoothie and ended up passing away because the E. coli infected his entire system. He was 2 years old and he died. So, I mean, those are the balancing acts that we're all having to live with.
Yeah, and I hear you loud and clear. I have five kids, two with diabetes, which isn't a foodborne illness, but I know it emotionally what that's meant to me as a parent just to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, this realization that there's even a potential that I might be bearing my children rather than the other way around. So I totally get that. But I think, you know, when I look as a businessman, because I'm a restaurateur, you know, we do about $2.5 million a year in my restaurant. And that's a small business to me, but yeah, I also know that because of the way I run my business, because I do shoot for a triple bottom line, and I do buy from local regional producers, I pay more for my food, I pay more wages, I pay higher wages. We have a very, very low turnover, but that's because I pay higher wages. I run about a 6% profit. A lot of these small farms run between a 6% and a 10% profit. So when you look at the it like $4,700 a year in expense to a $25,000 to $30,000 farm, that's going to wipe out their profits for a $250,000 farm in that range. You know, so I'm interested to know, you know, how they did the economic study of this. You know, is the cost for a $26,000 farmer going to be the same as a $250,000 farmer, or is this something that these guys are looking at a sliding scale? I don't know how much of this is systemic. I don't know how much of it is equipment. I'm not certain. If you could give us a little bit of shine a light on that, that would be terrific.
Yeah. I mean, basically, what it's doing is, and these are estimates. So the bigger the farm, the more likely they're going to have to spend some money. But the basic things are. Issues like making sure that the folks that are harvesting the produce have some place to wash their hands and to go to the bathroom, and things like that. If you're spraying water directly onto a leafy green in order to irrigate it, that and you're about to pick that and serve that leafy green raw, you know, you want to make sure that water doesn't have cow poop in it. So it's basic requirements like that. So for some farmers, frankly, it's probably going to cost them virtually nothing because they already do this, right? A lot of responsible farmers that you'll hear from are going to tell you, well, that's common sense. We already do that. For them, it may cost them virtually nothing because they're already doing this. For other farmers, you know, it may be that they have to do something in order to put porta-johns out in their fields when harvesting is happening or whatever, you know, or some wash station hands,
yeah,
that kind
it.
Of thing. So it's pretty elementary, but it's the kind of thing that time after time we've seen when there's an outbreak, it's pretty elementary stuff would have prevented it.
Well, especially when you get into stuff like hepatitis, because that some of the foodborne illnesses that are coming from produce that have been logged are things like hepatitis as well. So
right,
yeah. So that's all about hand washing now.
And there's one point I want to make, which is that I think there's been a fair amount of misinformation spread out there about what the impact of the rules are. And you know, if I believed half of what I've seen on the internet on some of this, I would be vigorously against any kind of protections.
Well, now listen, Eric, you have to believe it if it came from the internet. I mean, come on.
No, it's true. So, you know, I mean, if I believed all the stuff that I've seen out there, and rather than actually reading the rules and reading what's actually required and what's actually happening in the real world, I'd, you know, my hair would be on fire and I'd be running around screaming about it.
So, now there's a visual. Now I definitely want to bring David in on this. And Ralph Leglisi, who's communication director for Wholesome Wave that you know, worked on a lot of this stuff with Pew and John Hopkins Center, has a couple of comments he'd like to share because it's such a big subject. But, you know, I do have to say, about, to your point, Eric, about the whole internet thing, I've been reading about this whole scorched earth policy, and there seems to be an awful lot of confusion between the actual Modernization Act itself and the commercial requirements, product requirements being placed on farmers by big box retailers and large fast food industry.
Two totally different things.
And it's interesting because I know a lot of our small food hub operators that we deal with at Wholesome Wave likely aren't going to be supplying large big box retailers, but some of the bigger businesses that are more in the $5 to $10 million range could very well end up being having, you know, someone like Costco or Walmart as their customer. These are operations that actually should have, you know, HACCP plans, solid HACCP plans in place because they're moving a lot of food. So I understand that. Ralph, you had something I think you wanted to chime in.
I did. Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
So, you know, my background, I worked as a communications director previously with the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. So I know a lot about the regulations with food animals. And I think one thing that we've been talking about risk, and Michelle brought this up earlier, that in between 1996 and 2010, there were only 34 recorded deaths with produce and connected to foodborne illness. I don't know if that's, you know, if it's not really well documented, but compared to where they estimate that there are 3,000 deaths a year due to foodborne illness, does there seem to be that we're focusing, you know, so highly on, if we're worried about risk, why are they focusing so much attention on the produce farmers? And there's, you know, a lot of the groups are saying, well, it's because it's coming from the big guys who are saying, well, that we see them, you know, potentially as a risk, and let's turn the screws on them. But recognizing someone who understands public health fairly well, that we don't really want to make sure that everybody, that all food is safe, and that, you know, you don't want to give a get out of jail free card to, you know, just because they're a smaller producer. I understand that, but do you see that risk? That does it kind of jump out at you that just 34 deaths versus 3,000, and, you know, it does that strike you as something that maybe they should be focusing on food regulations,
yeah, well,
with food animals more
really
than just produce?
That you raise that point, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of those numbers, because the recorded deaths are the ones that actually get reported through this excruciating system. So if somebody dies, it has to be, they have to have a stool sample, they have to have verified, et cetera, et cetera. And it's, according to CDC, they estimate that it's for something like, say, salmonella, something like 1 in 30 of the people that actually get sick from salmonella from their food is actually recorded into the system. So what CDC does, and they actually put out a publication earlier this year, they do these national surveys, then they do state-by-state detailed epidemiological work and come up with a national estimate based on the data that is available. And that's where the 3,000 deaths and the 48 million illnesses and 128,000 hospitalizations come from. So what they do is they take the reported illnesses, they figure out how many for each reported illness or death, how many actually are likely to have occurred, and that's where those numbers come from.
Oh, interesting.
So then they did an attribution study where they tried to estimate which foods were causing the biggest numbers of illnesses. And interestingly, actually, produce is at the top of the list in terms of total numbers of illnesses, but meat and poultry tend to cause a higher percentage of the actual deaths and hospitalizations. So a lot of people get sick from produce. A fair number die. A fair number are hospitalized, including the child that I mentioned, unfortunately, and many others. But the recorded numbers tend to be much lower than the actual CDC estimates of the national numbers.
Yeah, and that makes sense, because so many foodborne illnesses really mimic the flu. They mimic stomach flu. They mimic intestinal flu, and often the infected are lucky enough not to be so infected that they don't just get over it within a 48-hour period of time. Now, Dave, you've been listening patiently. I wanted to bring you on because I've known you now for quite some time, and I've, you know, watched your business grow from a small holding organic farm into a large co-op, into a pretty reasonably sophisticated aggregation distribution. You've been involved in some light processing. Tell us about some of what you go through right now, because I know you're dealing with local health authorities, and how much you've been following this Modernization Act and what you feel it's going to mean to you and your business.
Well, I mean, of course, being a grower, we're really pretty much on the front lines. We just recently went through having one of our people we supply get shut down because of salmonella. So having seen what a business has to go through was a very educational process. Fortunately, it all turned out for the better, and it had nothing to do with the farms. But the whole food safety thing is becoming sort of the new compliance issue for growers. And, you know, I think my history as a certified organic grower, I've been doing this for 30 years now. I think, like Eric said, a lot of the fever people have about regs that are being written, I've never really seen something come to pass that literally shuts people down and when organics was getting rewritten by the federal government, there was a lot of brouhaha. But I think a lot of what food safety and compliance issues are going to really affect small farms is just common sense. And I think as our farm has grown, especially being a CSA farm, we're now inviting the general public on the farm, and we've done a lot to retrofit the farm, to move, you know, our equipment operation away from the processing area, upgrade our water facilities, the whole organic regs for a lot of our customers. We have to have each field recorded as a lot number, so whenever we pick a certain product, we have to record which field and which plantings are being harvested. So I think there's a lot of things in place for growers. We're a fairly large operation at 100 acres. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's really small. But, you know, this compliance program to me is a lot like, well, do you choose to build your business up so you have to bring on the idea of workers' comp?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, Dave. So I think what I'm hearing you saying, and through the iteration of the growth of your business, you voluntarily, in many cases, have made a lot of these changes to your farm just out of common sense and safety concerns. Some of them you're accustomed to having to make because the original organic certification really required a lot from and when you guys originally certified, you were not a 100-acre farm. So you're basically, would it be safe to say, for me to say that you've found all of the moves that you've made over time worth the investment and you've been able to realize a return on that investment, or it hasn't, has it or has it not put your business in peril, I guess would be the question.
No, it has not put our business in peril. I think the struggle I see, I especially always look out for startup farms. We've had the ability to do this over a 30-year period.
That's a great point.
Issues compliance today are really discouraging for somebody. God forbid they try to start with 100 acres. Let me tell you, I started with two. But I think, you know, as you're trying to establish a business and do a five-year plan to build this cost into your first couple, 3 years, it's going to be a significant impact with all the investment. You know, you have to buy equipment, you have to buy land, you need operating capital, and then there are all these fees, and, you know, organic certification certainly isn't as expensive as what this proposes. But I feel like the thing that I think concerns a lot of growers is there'll be this price tag you have to pay as a fee to be compliant. But the issue of the investment cost, I mean, we are currently looking at investing in our farm again to bring it up to speed. And that could be a price tag of up to $50,000. And the problem is, where's the incentive for the grower to do this when the price we're going to receive remains same? Consumer expects their produce to be like museum quality and pristine, but they want to pay less for it, not more. And the capital cost of putting in an upgraded water system, hand washing station, stainless steel vegetable washing equipment, it's not going to be something you can find in a junkyard. So I think some of those things are the real concern for me. You know, we try to encourage young people to get into agriculture. They look at this, and I would be discouraged. And I know a lot of young farmers choose not to be certified organic just because they don't want to pay the extra $1,000 a year.
Yeah, so I appreciate that perspective, Dave. We're starting to wind down on time. So, you know, in the first part of the show, when we had Roland and Roger on, it sounded like to them that pieces in the rules and regs during this comment period that were important to them were really taking a look at what is the percentage of direct-to-consumer sales that are happening on a farm that would, you know, either qualify or exempt somebody from these regulations. And the other was, you know, some kind of an extension or something to just give an opportunity for more comment, because these guys feel that the farming community was brought into the argument a little late. What it sounds to me, Dave, like what you're saying, for beginning farmers especially, maybe that $25,000 revenue might be too low of a revenue to be completely exempt, or maybe there should be some kind of an exemption for beginning farmers. There has to be something there. Listen, I'll tell you, I've seen food truck businesses do less than $25,000 a year. They're small businesses, but they certainly can poison people. I know that as an operator, I know that to be true. So, I'm wondering, what kind of, if not exemption, what kind of assistance or, what kind of consideration is being given so that we're actually not discouraging these literally tens of thousands of new young aspiring farmers who want to get on the land at a time that that farmers don't have heirs to their land. What do we do to make a consideration for them? Eric, how much has that come up in the conversation as you've been working with folks on these regulations? Because I know you've been talking to farmers as well as, folks from the Center for Science of the Public Interest and the FDA.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we actually hosted several major produce safety dialogues with farmers, where several hundred farmers and others from all over the regions where we held them, we did these, over a period of time to sort of hear what people thought, and we invited FDA to hear what the farmers were saying. And, we heard a lot of concerns. I think there was a lot of, as I said, misinformation, as you referred to, Michelle, yourself, where people thought that what was being required by a box store was going to be required by these rules. That's not the case. I think the key here is going to be for State Departments of Agriculture, for USDA and FDA to work together to have very simple guidelines that translate the regulations and the standards into plain English. Because, to be honest, a lot of this stuff is common sense. A lot of the farmers care about this stuff, and I think that's the vast majority, are already doing this. And, you're not going to do things like put feces directly onto, a field that you're about to harvest leafy greens from. You're not going to do things like, allow grazing right on top of the vegetables you're about to harvest that are served raw. So, it's basic stuff like that I think a reasonable farmer is already doing, and it's not going to cost them an arm and a leg to do it. But, I think just having some technical assistance is going to be key, and that's something FDA and U.S. Department of Agriculture have been discussing routinely, and I think you do need to bring the State Departments of Ag into that.
I think it would also be interesting, because we have seen, Wholesome Wave's been involved actually in some webinars and some like Pew has, getting some farmers, food hub operators, and FDA officials together for during this comment period. I'm wondering if what would be really helpful would be a larger symposium with USDA, State's Department of Agriculture, the FDA, some of these farmers, food hub operators of various sizes. It's interesting to me because even guys like Tom Damari, the largest tomato grower in the world, is so in favor of young farmers coming onto land, even if, like David, they can just take 2 acres. He just wants to see more, in his term, youngsters getting on the land and farming. So I'm wondering if there's a little bit of a missing step in broadening the tent, spreading the tent so that more people are at the table in this conversation. And that's what I'm going to leave everybody with as we go. The parting shot is, aside from the comment period, do we need to get more people at the table? I think what you said, Eric, by bringing the State's Department of Agriculture would be a really great step, and that certainly gives us something to chew on. Are you going to be working on that, Eric?
We're working on it, and we've already done quite a number of those meetings. So, absolutely.
That's beautiful.
That's critical.
Well, I look forward to more of that and staying in touch with you on that. David, thanks a million for all the great things that you do with your farm. Before we split, I just want to give everybody a quick update. Congress is away. They're on vacation. As we know, we tried 2 years in a row to get a farm bill passed, and it just didn't happen. So whether you're in favor or not in favor of a farm bill, I just want to encourage you listeners that are out there, whatever side you land on, now is the time for you to be stalking the local diners where your representatives are having their bacon and egg breakfast or bagel and coffee, and give them an earful of what you want. Let them know where you stand. This is the time. Certainly something in the form of a farm bill and a food and nutrition bill are important to all Americans, to many millions of Americans. It's not a small subject, so I would encourage you, as we take our parting shot here, to choose carefully where you have your breakfast over the next few weeks and try to find yourself next to one of your elected officials and let them know how you feel. I want to thank everybody for joining. Eric, thank you. Ralph, thanks for being a sidekick. Great question. And David, thank you. I'm Michelle Nashan. It's More Than Food. And we'll see you next month, same time, same place, on the Heritage Radio Network at heritageradio.org. The bios of all of our great guests today are available there. And you can log on and click and hear this segment, if you wish, over and over again. It's More Than Food. Take care and have a delicious weekend.
Gotta get started. I've got to be the one who makes me.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
A sustainable life.